Thank you so much for the introduction. And yeah, I'm going to talk about cosmology and astrophysics with the background and fluctuations of the extragalactic light. So this is a big summary of everything we get to see in the universe. This is the cosmic background radiation across a wide range of frequencies. And at each frequency, this emission is dominated by different physical processes, right? So this is a collection of observations from this review paper. And the width of this line is proportional to our errors in measurement. So the thinner parts of the plot are the most well-measured ones, which are, of course, the CMB over here. And so we've measured this particular portion of this plot very well with a cosmic microwave background, with absolute intensity measurements. So the spectrum that I was showing before with COBE and its fluctuations was made increasingly more precise between, you know, COBE, WMAP, and Planck. So we mapped the surface of last scattering over here very precisely and revolutionized the way we think about cosmology, about the Big Bang, et cetera. But we can look at other portions of this plot that are, again, dominated by different physical processes. And the second largest contribution here is this infrared and optical background range. And you can see that we understand it. We've measured it to a much lesser precision, but we can still think about it in a similar way. And in particular, in this range here, these emissions are mainly dominated by stellar emissions and by the reprocessing of this emission by dust within galaxies. So this is really probing the galactic population in the universe. And so, for example, in the infrared range of that plot, we've, again, even though to a lesser precision, have measured both the absolute intensity and the fluctuations of this intensity, for example, with COBE and, again, with Planck, as shown in these plots. But instead of probing just this, like a thin surface, we're really probing the entire volume of the universe by measuring all of this light. And in particular, the infrared background is primarily dominated by these dusty star-forming galaxies that fill the universe. And so just to give kind of a physical sense of what we're talking about, the image that I showed before of Planck was of a particular band, 544 gigahertz. And I've overlaid this just with the SED of a galaxy. So essentially, you're mapping the whole universe in this particular frequency. But you're measuring not just a single galaxy like I've shown here with its rest frame wavelength on the x-axis. But you're measuring all of the galaxies and across all redshifts. So this is being integrated across a very wide range of sources. Now, another way we can think about this integrated emission is through line intensity mapping, where instead of just measuring a single frequency across the sky, we're really targeting specific emission lines. So for example, in the spectral energy distribution of this galaxy, we can target a specific line, let's say carbon monoxide, which is one that people look for. And instead of just mapping at this individual frequency, we can target this frequency at various redshifts by measuring different redshifted frequencies. And so this is a strategy for building a 3D map of the universe. And so the topic of this talk is essentially to discuss this absolute background and these fluctuation measurements, but now looking at this range of frequencies where we're dominated by galaxies as opposed to the CMB, for example. And I'll go through a few of the some of these scientific cases that and some things we can probe with these types of measurements. So I'm going to start by looking at measurements of absolute intensity, and in particular, how we can use this to constrain models of dark matter candidates. So again, coming back to this plot. This is the same plot we were looking at before, specifically in this range between the infrared and the optical. This is the result from a recent measurement. And again, here now on the left-hand side, we have this optical range that is dominated by stars. The right-hand side, we have this light that is reprocessed by dust. And a few interesting points about this plot are that these curves down here are indirect determination from galaxy counts. So you look at all of the galaxies, you account for all of the light that they emit, and this is what we expect all the galaxies, what the light from all the galaxies that we observe to produce. But if we go and look directly and try to make an absolute measurement of the intensity in the sky, what we find are these points over here, and they tend to lie above the curves from galaxies. Now, this can be for a few reasons. One of them is that this is a very difficult measurement to make, and between us and the extragalactic light, there are a bunch of things. For example, instrument noise, solar system foregrounds, galactic foregrounds, and then you get to your extragalactic light. But another reason is that we may have a large diffuse component, a large diffuse source of radiation in the universe. And these can include, for example, interhalo light. They can include, say, unresolved sources that your galaxies that you were using to infer these curves over here cannot resolve. They can include, for example, people have talked about direct collapse black holes, but you can also imagine some more exotic source of radiation, like dark matter that can decay into photons. And in general, this kind of measurement will give you kind of a broad strokes integrated information. You're really just measuring, you know, the absolute intensity at a given frequency. But it can be used to answer, I think, one really interesting consistency test, which is, did we count everything? You know, did we account for all of the sources of radiation that we think might be out there? And so this is something, so this is the answer at the moment to this question seems to be no. So the plot that I showed before was from last year, and earlier this year, the most significant measurement of this background in the optical range was performed by the New Horizons spacecraft in this range from 0.4 to 0.9 microns at a very large distance from the sun. Now, if you recognize the New Horizons, you may remember it as this instrument that flew to the outer solar system and took these really really cool pictures of Pluto. But in the process of flying to the outer solar system to take these, it also got away from the main source of contamination to these types of measurements, which are zodiacal light. So this is light from the sun that scatters off dust in the inner solar system. And this is the main source of contamination if you're trying to make these like absolute photometry measurements of this background. And actually, Lori, this camera that made this measurement is this little opening here.
Maybe you'll get to it in a second, but does it matter where I look? Does it matter how much of the sky I look at average to get into the monopole?
Yeah, it matters a lot. Like, they had a lot of work determining the fields that they could look at. And actually, once you're trying to look like away from the sun, away from the galaxy. And they also have another really big source of noise is actually light that reflects out of other parts of their of the spacecraft. And so that actually leaves like not that much wiggle room. So that's how they choose their fields. Cool.
Okay.
Yes.
I mean, that's LARIA's long-range reconnaissance imager, right? It was
yes.
For spotting.
Yeah.
Do you know if there was attention paid to like doing any on-ground calibration or work on the instrument to enable this? Event, or is this fortuitous?
So this result earlier this year, their most constraining result was targeted. Like Lori had other purposes. Okay. In 2021, they had one result where they just used archival data, and they found a few. They tested this approach with archival data, and then later went out and asked for time to do these specific ones. So, yeah, yeah, they had other plans.
So I have a question. How do they treat point sources? Do they mask them, like stars, galaxies, or that's included?
Yeah, they mask the resolved sources. Like Lori has a very shallow field, so they don't resolve that many things. But yeah, they do mask them.
Well, so it means that in their measurement, the faint sources are just considered as background, right?
Yeah.
I mean, inside their measurement, yeah?
Yes. Yeah, they're trying to measure, yeah, the diffuse, the faint sources, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I see. Thanks.
Okay. Any other questions? All right. Right. So this is the measurement that they made. I guess just to avoid confusion here, the optical background is supposed to be all of the extragalactic sources, which include what we expect from galaxies, which is this blue bar here. And all of the other colors are foregrounds, contamination, instrument noise, et cetera. And so when you add what you expect from what we know from galaxies plus all of the foregrounds, this gets us to this point with these error bars. But what they actually measured is way over here, which is this anomalous contribution. And so this means that they did find some, you know, source of radiation that was not coming from all of our known population of galaxies. And what we did in this work was...
Sort of a follow-up on a previous question.
Yeah.
So what was the field of view of this? And, you know... So how much cosmic variance, I guess, you know, to expect, I guess, overall?
Yeah, it was a really small area. They do account for variance.
Okay, so there's like sample variance from that.
Yeah, yeah. Among other things, yeah.
But what field of view actually, like, was this?
It's really small. I forget the number, but it's like tiny.
Okay, so they represent.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Okay. So yeah, in this work, we kind of explore this possibility that this can be produced by some exotic source, for example, dark matter that decays into radiation. So the relevant model here for this discussion are axion-like particles. So axions are this proposed solution to the strong CP problem. Axion-like particles are this generalization that are unrelated to solving the strong CP problem, but they nevertheless can arise in a variety of beyond standard model theories. And they can come in a variety of masses with a wide range of phenomenology, and they're one of the more well-motivated candidate dark matter particles. And one of the main strategies for detecting them is through their coupling to photons. So they can undergo this two-photon decay and produce these photons whose energy are half of the energy of this particle. And the decay rate, the rate that this happens is then a function of this coupling constant, which is shown in this plot here, and of the mass. But unlike the QCD axion, the coupling constant is unrelated to the mass, so the QCD band would fall here. In our range of interest to produce optical photons, these are ruled out, but we do have a very wide range of parameter space for axion-like particles that have not been constrained so far. So what we expect to see then is this essentially emission line produced by this decay of dark matter. where the intensity of this decay line is at a given observed wavelength lambda and produced at a redshift Z star is then proportional to this decay rate gamma A. And what we find is that the region parameter space here, this purple band, that you would need to explain this excess is unconstrained to date. Just quickly, the other curves here, for example, globular clusters are constraints that come from like stellar evolution and the radiative added radiative process that you would get from having axions in stars. The other mus and vmos are basically directly imaging clusters and looking for these decay lines directly. So these are also ruled out. And then there's this hint, interestingly, that overlaps with our with our optical background excess in this hint from gamma rays from Blazar, which is interesting. And then this same region of parameter space would also be probed by intensity mapping experiments, because again, they're just looking at the same range of frequencies, and you could see them as anisotropies in this in an intensity mapping experiment. So this motivated us to look at other ways that we could probe these models of decaying dark matter. So this measurement that I talked about before is essentially this absolute photometry measurement. You're just trying to capture all of the photons that you see at a given frequency. But you could also, there are also indirect approaches to measuring this background light, which is through the attenuation of gamma rays. So the idea here is that you have a blazar, so an AGN, very energetic AGN with its jet pointing to us. It's producing gamma rays. These gamma rays, as they travel across the universe to us, will encounter photons in this extragalactic background light. They'll pair produce. And so the spectrum of gamma rays that you would see originally gets attenuated by the presence of these optical photons. But this is an indirect way to measure this background light. So the EBL essentially acts as this screen through which these gamma rays will pass through with an optical depth given by tau here, which is an integral from us to the source blazar over this mean free path, which is then given essentially as a sum of all of these extragalactic background light photons across all of the energies where this can occur. So the left-hand side here, the optical depth was measured by Fermilat and Cherenkov telescope from around 800 blazars. So this is can be measured directly and is public data. Whereas the right-hand side is our model for all of the photons, the extragalactic background light photons, which includes galaxies before reionization, above reionization, intrahalo light, plus some additional contribution. Yes.
How do we know the intrinsic luminosity of the blazar so that we know that some of the photons have been converted?
Yeah. So there are it's modeled. It relies both on looking at lower redshifts that are somewhat unattenuated, and you also fit essentially the part of the spectrum that is unattenuated and extrapolate to higher frequencies. So it relies on certain assumptions, but you can model this population together.
And in that model, EBL is assumed as just uniform. It's just a uniform fluid. It's
Phrase
up properly.
Yeah.
So do sort of optical bursts of blazars complicate this modeling at all, or is that not the perfect spectrum that you're interested in, and so they're more stable?
What range? It would not affect the spectrum. These are very energetic.
Okay.
Yeah, so essentially we then model the right hand side of this equation, counting up all of the expected sources of extragalactic background light photons. And what we find from this exercise is the following. So this again is this the coupling constant and the decay rate here. What we were looking at before was this optical background excess, and now we've added this gray blob here from this work. We find that there is a two sigma preference for an excess for an ALP contribution, and this falls in this unconstrained region. There is an unconstrained region of this of parameter space. And it also overlaps with this cosmic optical background excess. But upon a, I guess, kind of simple null test, which was to boost the galaxy contribution. So instead of adding this component of ALPs, we just boost all of the known galaxies to some number, which is this F. And we find a stronger preference for that model over the ALP model. And this is essentially driven by the fact that ALPs provide a poor constraint to the local blazars that we see. And so we interpret this then as this bound, which is this gray curve, the gray line over here. And then finally, something that, as another independent search for the same region of parameter space, one thing I'm interested in now is these a direct telescope search. And this is very much ongoing work, but essentially then, again, we can directly search for these decay lines in images of resolved galaxy clusters. So if you have...
Before this, can I ask about the previous thing?
Yeah. From here?
So is there any, line emission coming from the positrons that are produced by this process, and then could you use that, to see how much of this, how much of this attenuation actually is happening?
I don't know if, I'm not sure. Seems reasonable, but I don't know if this is done. Okay. Right. So if we have direct images from a resolved galaxy cluster, and we have observationally determined mass model gravitational lensing, so we know what the mass distribution of this cluster is. And on top of that, we have spectra from this BMOS integral field unit. So basically, integral field units are this like really cool technique where you basically have a spectrum for each point in an image. You can directly search for a decay line that is correlated with the mass distribution. This is what we expect this signal to look like. So we can have a much more specific search for this type of signature. So the idea then is for each frequency, for each wavelength lambda, you would then fit a contribution that is proportional to the mass density from a contribution that is uncorrelated to the mass density. And if you do have this decay line, you would see this as a correlation in the component that is correlated to this mass distribution. And essentially, this would then extend. So this curve was there before, and this search would extend to this region of parameter space, which is precisely where is like most of the available parameter space in that is relevant to this discussion of the optical background excess. Okay.
Wait. Sorry, I didn't understand. So you're looking for just diffuse optical light from the cluster.
Yeah.
Right, but clusters do just emit diffuse light. So then, how do you distinguish that from this?
Yeah. So you'd have to. You're looking specifically for a decay line. If it yes, yeah. So it's a line. It has to have, for example, the broadening that corresponds to like the velocity, the dispersion velocity of your cluster. It's a, there are these more specific things you can look for. And of course, if you have some like emission line that coincides with the frequency, you would have to discard that, right? but yeah.
Thanks.
Okay, so before I move on, are there any questions about this portion of the talk?
Yeah. I'll ask you, like, for the residual parameter space you are looking at, like, what is the target for freezing of atoms?
Sorry, can you repeat the last part?
So what is the target for a freezing component of axons in those places?
So I think that most the models are typically produced by misalignment, not by not like reason. For the
okay, so those what allergy misalignment.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Okay.
Any other questions about this? All right, so we've talked about this measurement of absolute intensity, and now I'm going to turn my attention to intensity fluctuations, namely line intensity mapping. And so once again, the idea is that we have these galaxies with a given SED, and we're targeting line emissions. So here I've just selected a few sample emissions that people like to target. And this is what the universe looks like according through these lines. So this is the underlying matter distribution. This is about one square degree at redshift 2.5. And this is what this same distribution looks like across various emission lines. So the idea is that they're all, you know, probing the same underlying matter distribution, but they're also slightly different because they're coming from different astrophysical processes. So different lines are produced by different mechanisms inside of a galaxy. So for example, CO is typically tracing this like cold molecular gas that is the like reservoir for star formation. C2 is typically, it's this very strong cooling line, and it's typically probing these photo dissociation regions, which are regions around these like very bright, massive stars. Whereas Lyman Alpha is probing the atomic gas, but it also gets absorbed and re-emitted throughout the interstellar and intergalactic medium, so you get this more diffuse component. And then you can take these maps and look at different frequencies, which correspond to different redshifts, and stack them, and essentially construct this 3D map of the universe. And these have a few, I guess, features. For example, you no longer have to resolve individual galaxies. So this allows you to push to look at higher redshifts and measure things that would be, say, below your detection limit for galaxy surveys. And there are three main there are three main features that get brought up usually when talking about line intensity mapping, and I kind of wanted to go through them. There's like three like prolim arguments and what they imply for astrophysics and cosmology, like what more can we do with this type of measurement given these like unique features of intensity mapping observations. So one of them is this wide redshift coverage. If you're looking at, again, by mapping different frequencies, you're mapping higher redshifts. And it's one of the, I guess, more most one of the leading ways that you can target, for example, the very high redshift universe in large volumes. So in terms of cosmology, this implies that you can measure this evolution of cosmological parameters. You can, for example, try to measure to perform, you know, large-scale structure measurements at higher redshifts than we currently do, and try to measure the evolution, say, of dark energy, or, and you can also break parameter degeneracies by covering a wider range of redshifts. In terms of astrophysics, this is very interesting from the point of view of galaxy evolution, because you are measuring the, you can try to measure the first stars and the first galaxies in the universe. You can try to probe, you know, since cosmic, from cosmic dawn to the reionization of the universe, and even, and cosmic noon, for example, when star formation peaked around redshifts 2 and 3. And I've worked on this more astrophysical front, essentially proposing this estimator that can capture the evolution of the epoch of reionization. So this estimator is anti-symmetric cross-correlation estimator, essentially looks at the cross-correlation between carbon monoxide line and the neutral hydrogen line. And the idea is that, you know, if you have in the very before reionization starts, you have the neutral hydrogen and the carbon monoxide tracing this matter distribution. As reionization evolves, these reionization bubbles starts to grow, and these two things go from being initially positively correlated to being negatively correlated with time. And this anti-symmetric cross-correlation essentially isolates this evolution specifically. And we showed that you can get more information from your measurements by considering it, and that it's also expected to be more robust to foregrounds. Another in the list of these pro-intensity mapping arguments are that it captures these faint and diffuse sources, right? So because you're not individually targeting galaxies and trying to resolve them, you're measuring, you can measure faint and faint galaxies, dwarf galaxies that you would not measure with other strategies. And you can also measure this intergalactic and intrahalo light. So this is, these are the implications for astrophysics and for cosmology. We've talked about these, how it can be used to test dark matter candidates before through its decay into radiation. But you can also imagine that since you're probing fainter objects, lower mass objects, you could also become sensitive to how these things are suppressed in like non-CDM dark matter models. So I won't.
The previous things are right.
Yeah.
Yes, you mentioned this anti-symmetric, so are you, anti-symmetrizing in the radial direction specifically?
Yeah. So it's like at different times, I guess.
Oh, okay. Now, what sort of ranges of this, you know, X prime are you planning to?
You can consider any range that you want. At some point, they'll become decorrelated, right? Because you get to, as you get to larger and larger redshifts. But yeah, it's arbitrary. Or it's general, sorry.
Okay. But you'll be focusing, presumably, on some sort of like time difference, I guess. I was curious, like what?
Yeah. Well, you can construct these cross correlations between any redshifts that you're measuring in your survey, right? So the closer, the more correlated they will be, but yeah.
Okay.
Sorry, was that not?
Yeah, that's good.
Okay. Cool. Right, so you can capture faint sources, and I won't, I mean, we've already talked about a bit about how you can capture diffuse sources with these types of measurements of unresolved sources. And then finally, the third argument is that you can quickly map large volumes of the universe. So even though current experiments are very are small pathfinders, in principle, they can be scaled up pretty easily because you're not individually, again, targeting sources. There's no, you don't need to like put a fiber on a galaxy to measure its spectra or whatever. Like, you're just mapping all of these sources at once. And this in turn translates into a feature for astrophysics, which is that you measure the average properties of the interstellar and the intergalactic medium. You're not measuring just a few very special sources that happen to be bright enough to be picked up. You're really measuring like the average population. But these can also include sources that you might not have been lucky enough to capture in like a very small field. So you can also, in principle, try to find rare objects. And then in terms of cosmology, of course, it's always interesting to measure, you know, large scale modes. And in particular, this can be used to test models of inflation because of its effect on the largest scales in the universe. And this is another thing I have worked on. So if you have line intensity mapping it as a direct probe of large scale structure, you can think about this as a way to extend measurements that we want to do with galaxies into, you know, higher redshifts. So if we combine this with, for example, this kinetic Zuniev-Zoldovich effect, which is the effect of scattering of CMB photons off intervening structure, so in particular, the bulk motion of electrons, these will impart temperature fluctuations on the CMB. And in this work, we showed that by combining these two things, we can improve constraints on models of the early universe, in particular that feature primordial non-Gaussianity and also compensated isocurvature fluctuations, which are these fluctuations between isocurvature and adiabatic modes in the early universe. Yeah.
Sorry, are you talking about some generic non-intensity mapping or something in particular?
Yeah, this one we focused on carbon, on ionized carbon, so C2. But in principle, if you're thinking it purely as like a way to measure large scale structure, you could look at any line. We do focus on C2 though. And up to redshift 5, so not reionization. and in particular, we find that having this higher redshift coverage helps us really improve these constraints. And we find a 3x improvement by including this combination of intensity mapping as a tracer of. What do I do?
I lost the Zoom.
But I also lost my screen. How is that? It's still here. It's just not.
There is like a health button. Maybe we could push. And just like a summoner goes. Or if they're listening, I mean,
Josh. send up the Josh bat signal.
Craig. Yeah, sorry about that. That failure mode, I think, hasn't yet happened, so congratulations, you're the first.
This is the improv portion of your talk.
I can just continue to describe the plot with words. Yellow blob was larger than the red blob.
I had a basic question, maybe you can answer.
Yeah.
Or waiting. So, you know, you showed us a picture of the SED for one or two galaxies with the relative, you know, importance of the line emission.
Yeah.
I just have no idea, like, how variable do we expect those to be among different populations?
Yeah, galaxy SEDs vary a lot. There are vast libraries of different galaxy types with different looking SEDs. And then what you would measure would be this like aggregate of all of them.
Does the line emission always go above the continuum so that you can actually pick out, how much can you distinguish the lines from the continuum?
Yeah.
That's a different way of asking the question.
So that's a very important question that people are dealing with for these. Oh, cool. that people are dealing with these measurements. Part of the problem is that, you know, that was one galaxy, but when you look at all of them, you're really integrating all of these together. And so it's not just the continuum from one galaxy, it's the continuum from all galaxies in the entire universe that have been redshifted to this, the frequency of that line. The good part is that it's actually kind of information, right? Like these are also produced by, you know, dust, for example, which are correlated with large scale structure. And so there are like component separation techniques that people use. And there's also, I guess, this idea of like using this also as information, not just noise. But it's hard. Right, so there's this promising picture starting to develop. This is a plot of the field of view of different instruments and the redshift that they cover. And all of these lines here are different instruments targeting all of these lines. So this does not include 21 centimeter. This would be a much more populated plot if it included 21 centimeter. But the point is that there is a vast number of experiments starting to pop up, starting to make these measurements for the first time. Many of them are small. Most of them are like small pathfinders. And so we're really starting to look at the universe for the first time with these tools. And on top, so there's an interesting prospect of looking at all of these things together. As I mentioned, these are all produced by different but related processes inside, astrophysical processes happening inside of a galaxy. So really considering all of these together is something that has a lot of interest in the community. But also, these instruments overlap not just with themselves. So here, COMAP is this pointed here, overlaps, for example, with other intensity mapping surveys like HETDEX, XCLAIM, but also with a bunch of other tracers of large of other instruments trying to measure large-scale structure. So like galaxies, you have DESI, this is DS. And you also have CMB observations. So the gray here is Simons Observatory. So there's this interesting prospect, not just with LIM by itself, LIM with other lines, and then aggregating all of these different tracers of large-scale structure. But there are a variety of challenges. We've talked about just one of them right now, about these continuum foregrounds. There are, of course, many others. And so I kind of wanted to talk a little bit about those and how, I guess, I've been thinking about them and some approaches to better model, better quantify them, and understand where we need to be if we want to do all of the things that I listed in this table. So most of the experiments that we talked about before focus mainly on this part of this table and on this part of this table. So they're trying to measure this aggregate, these average properties of the interstellar and intergalactic medium. And then the name of the game is like, how do we translate that into astrophysically interesting quantities that we can use to actually test galaxy formation models? And that's something that, you know, there are many people in the field doing. Well, I shouldn't say many, it's a small field, but there are people, there are several people trying to do this. But other, most of the other parts of this plot are very like aspirational, and they have not necessarily been demonstrated in practice. So one very big challenge for this column here is that the way that we interpret our data, namely through two-point correlation functions, is not sensitive to these diffuse contributions. And I'll talk more about that in later. Another really big question here is that, you know, this whole section about cosmology relies a lot on our ability to, for example, remove foregrounds, deal with all of these sources of contamination properly. And the degree to which we need to do this is not even well understood, and specifically how this varies between, you know, different lines. Say if I want to use this, you know, as a tool for large-scale structure, which line is better, you know, which one is easier to deal with the foregrounds. How much do we need to remove them if we want to recover modes, say, along the line of sight? Well, if we want to do like correlations like the one I talked about with like the CMB, for example. For any point that we look here, there are a million questions about how we can actually do it. And so I'll spend the rest of the talk. I don't know how much time I actually have, but I'll spend the rest of the talk discussing one, a modeling tool that I've been developing with collaborators that will help us quantify these things. It will be a very interesting playground to even be able to ask some of these questions and quantify them more precisely. And also this arrow here, statistical tools that we use to analyze our data and retrieve and get information out of it. So I'm going to start with the arrow, actually. So again, for us to get to learn from these intensity maps, we need to measure summary statistics, right? And what we typically do is measure the power spectrum, which is the degree of clustering of a map. And for line intensity mapping, this will have this clustering contribution, as usual, which will depend on the matter power spectrum. And it will also depend on this clustering term, on the first moment of the luminosity function, and in the shot noise on the second moment of the luminosity function. So this is really only capturing these first two moments, and this distribution is very non-Gaussian. It has many more moments than this. And one approach to deal with this is to look at other statistical tools. So for example, we can look at this voxel intensity distribution, which is just the one-point function of your map. So the probability of measuring a given temperature T in a given pixel. And this is given by the probability that there are n sources in that pixel times the probability that these n sources produce an aggregate temperature T summed over all possible number of sources. And in practice, what this is just a histogram, right? You take your map, you pixelize it, and you count how many pixels of a given temperature you see. And this is the estimator that we have. And this will depend on the full luminosity function and on the full matter PDF of your sources. And so to see this visually, this plot is showing here on the bottom, this gray curve is this PDF that we were talking about. This is the histogram itself, not the PDF. And so at each temperature, we can plot this, the luminosity times the abundance of these objects. So for all objects, we see this gray curve, which is essentially what your power spectrum is measuring. The clustering term that I showed before is captured in this gray curve. But as I look at pixels with different temperatures, you can actually see that the fainter pixels here, for example, are actually probing a different mass range. They're probing a different population of halos. So you can obtain information from a different population of sources by looking at this other statistic. And this in particular is for carbon monoxide, again at redshift 3. And we developed a way to combine the information from the power spectrum and from this one-point statistic for line intensity maps. If you want to measure these two things together, we need to understand how to combine this information. And in this work, we derived the first analytical covariance between these two observables, the covariance between a one-point statistic and a two-point statistic. Is a three-point statistic, and we found good agreement with simulated measurements of this covariance. And so when we're talking, so now I'm going to talk a bit more about this simulation technique. You talked about better statistics. Now we'll talk a little bit about better models. And let me know if I should stop at any point. I've like completely lost track of time with this like interruption.
It's okay if it's a little.
Okay.
Okay.
So in order to address all of these problems that we've been discussing and to quantify, you know, how we can realize the aspirational table I was showing before, we need ways to, you know, model both our signal and our noise, and to test these analysis tools that we've been discussing
under these
like realistic scenarios. And so we've been developing this way to simulate these maps that include not just, you know, the source, so again, our little galaxy SCD with the source of the line emission, but you also expect to see line interlopers. So as you, for example, say you're targeting this C2 line here at a given redshift, as you target it at higher and higher redshifts, you'll start to see other spectral lines at lower redshifts that are observed in the same frequency range that you're targeting. So these are called line interlopers. You also expect to see this continuum emission or correlated foregrounds because they're correlated to the matter distribution. You also expect to see Milky Way foregrounds, instrument noise, and perhaps other diffuse sources of radiation. And so your total map is going to be composed of all of these things. And so we're developing this tool that we're calling Skyline to model all of these things together and produce realistic maps of line intensity. So these are the first, I think, full sky flexible line intensity mapping light cones. They span redshifts 0 to 10, and we use this universe machine galaxy formation model to derive properties of galaxies that we based our line emission predictions on. This is a modular implementation, so we can really apply like empirical models to predict a large range of line emissions together, like from the same matter distribution. And it also captures most of these realistic sources of noise, as well as like different geometrical effects that you expect to have in observing, you know, certain volumes of the universe. And I haven't put a lot of detail in here on how we do this. But if you're curious about it, please ask me about it, because I have a lot of like diagrams and stuff. Okay, and so we start from this matter distribution. We apply these models to predict the signal, and we also have a variety of sources of foregrounds that we add on top of this. I think this is like a really interesting playground to like realize realistic instruments and throw our tools on it and see what we can really do and test these techniques. Another thing that I'm really excited about that is a feature of this is that we've developed these simulations kind of in tandem with a collaborator, Yuki Omori, who has the same underlying like simulation, the same galaxies, all of the same assumptions, the same method of producing these light cones, but has produced a wide range of galaxy and CMB, extragalactic CMB foregrounds from all of the same assumptions. So on top of all of these intensity lines, we also have like CMB lensing, there are like shear galaxy catalogs, we have thermal Sunyev Zeldovich, kinetic Sunyev Zeldovich, the infrared background, etc. So in total, then we have halos and galaxies with properties a wide range of properties that we can access. The properties of gas, so we can produce any number of line intensity maps and plus galaxy and CMB catalogs from the same underlying assumptions. So just a few interesting, I think, snapshots of what we can probe. You know, for example, with carbon monoxide, you're probing this like cold molecular gas. With the TSC, you're probing like hot, very ionized sources. Between all the emission lines that you have, plus the continuum that you probe with the CMB, you're really probing the whole SED of the galaxy together. And so, for example, exploring what you can do by modeling these things together can be really interesting. Between Lyman alpha and 21 centimeter, you're probing the neutral hydrogen. The KSC, you're probing ionized free electrons. And so I think this, in the future, I look forward to using this as a tool to realize all of this, you know, to understand how we can realize this like promise of line intensity mapping, and to explore synergies between various tracers, between line intensity mapping and itself. And yeah, and I also think about proper timing arrays, so you can ask me about that later. But yeah, thank you.
So maybe I'll just take a couple of minutes to ask Gabriel a couple of questions.
I've always wondered about this, maybe you can explain it to me. So so help me understand the shot noise term for line intensity mapping. So, you know, we're imagining that the IGM is this continuous field of gas that we're trying to probe. So why do I have a shot noise associated with that?
Because it's still produced by galaxies, right? It's still, there's still like the galaxy shot noise contribution. Like the emission is still sourced within a discrete object.
Yes. Yeah. So I can reduce it by measuring. So if I imagine like going down the more and more units of the thing that's producing this, I could beat that down. And so is it a function of like how much of the luminosity function I can sample in my experiment, or it's a function of the size of my pixel?
It's really just like an intrinsic property of like the fact that galaxies are the ones producing the emission line. So it's not really, even if you had like the perfect resolution, you would still have this like shot noise.
So you can reduce it by observing more galaxies, is that the...
So here you're already measuring, like, so in a galaxy survey, yes, right? But here you're already measuring the whole population. So it is, you know, it is just the second moment of the luminosity function.
So here's my confusion, because if I think of dark matter in the context of the halo model, you know, I can measure down to smaller and smaller halos, and I get rid of the shot noise because eventually I just measure all the dark matter and that continuous field that I've imagined discretizing into halos. And so here I can't get rid of it because there is a fundamental smallest unit of emission producing blobs, or why can't I ever get rid of it?
Yeah, I mean, below a certain mass, you don't expect to have like star formation, right? So there's a limit to how much you can subdivide your, like if you just had like stars like scattered anywhere, that would minimize your shot noise. But unless like that were the universe that we lived in, like I guess there's no getting around.
It's very brilliant.
But in the halo model, right? You know, so there would be a dark matter white noise term. Right, but this doesn't happen, you know, in reality, because, you know, if you like the halo fields from halo pin, you know, you know, so their Poisson noises are actually somewhat anti-correlated and they cancel out on their scales, right? You know, so for your sort of sources, I mean, well, right, so as she said, you know, so on large scales there will be a white noise contribution. Okay.
So in the first part of your talk, you were talking about the sort of telescope search for emission light that comes from dark matter annihilation. And I'm curious if you have thoughts on like how that kind of search, could you extend that to like a line intensity mapping context, look for like higher signals? Like, would unexpected lines show up in a way that you could look for in a line intensity map analysis, maybe through like cross-correlation sequencing or something?
Yeah, so that's a thing. So there are papers about this. Jose Luis Bernal and collaborators have, it basically acts as a line interloper, right? So instead of having an interloper that is like a known emission line, it would just be a, like, this emitter from, you know, at a given frequency and then from all of the redshift. So you can actually try to detect it through measurements of the power spectrum or like this one point statistic.
Oh, like we're past time though. I mean, yes, we want to stop and close it. Okay, well, yeah. Like, you know, so we're 21 centimeter density mapping, right? So there is this, you know, problem about the foreground lines that we have to cut out. Is there some analog for these different lines? Or?
So these lines have also will have, you know, Milky Way foreground contamination, but it's much lower. Like synchrotron really takes off, right? But for CO, like at redshift 3, it's like 30 gigahertz. For C2, you're like in the higher frequencies that you'd probe with like a CMB experiment. So it's not as dramatic. It's still a problem that needs to be removed, and it will still like contaminate. There will be some contamination, but it's a lot less significant. They then suffer more from the continuum emission, the issue with continuum emission. But then those, I think, and line interlopers. So those are the main two sources of contamination for these other lines. And I think that it's interesting that they have like more, we have more tools to remove them, right? Because they are like correlated with the matter distribution. So with like line interlopers, you know, you have more strategies to remove them than with like Milky Way foregrounds.
Okay, so I think everyone will get